Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's our monthly book show. The brain is our theme. With us, retired reference librarian Jill Erickson. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Jane Ifrady. She's the past chair of Falmouth Reads Together. Hi, Jane.
Good morning, Mindy.
This was your brilliant idea, the brain. Yeah.
Could you explain what your brain was thinking
I must just have had a
Who doesn't like, everybody loves the brain, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's everything, right? Yeah, sort of exactly. Like Moby Dick, right? It's everything.
All right, start us off then. What have you got to kick off the show?
The brain, I always think of, like, there's such a wealth of nonfiction out there, but I gravitated toward fiction where I could and found some really, I think, some interesting choices. And so the first one on my list is The Unconsoled by Katsu Ishiguro, who is a Nobel Prize winner, mostly known for The Remains of the Day and a lot of these, sort of very insightful inner dialogue sorts of stories. And I came to him because I was reading last month a number of reflections on Alison Munro's death. And they kept referring to this book, The Unconsoled. And the New York Times, in fact, in one of their recommendations for Munro, what is the essential Munro to read, they referred to In Sight of the Lake, which was her last collection, and said, this is Munro's Kafka story, her swerve into the lane of Ishiguro's Unconsoled. So I was like, okay, I'm there. I'm in. So Ishiguro himself described The Unconsoled as an experiment in writing the language of dreams. Mm. And every chapter, this is a wonderful read. I mean, every chapter begins with the protagonist, Ryder. He wakes up in a different place, and he almost doesn't really know where he is or what he's doing. He wakes up into this new world every morning where a closet leads to a party. A doorway leads to another dimension of life. He's meeting all these people that he's never met before, but they all know him. It's this kind of crazy, crazy dream world. And what Ishiguro said in his discussions of this book is that he really wanted to put somebody into the brain to have them understand sort of the kind of the wild environment that that's going on up there. And in fact, he calls it an experiment in disorientation.
I love this, though, because this is a book you can't predict, right? You don't know where you're going.
No. Every morning he wakes up, it's a whole new world.
I love it.
And it's just a fascinating. It's long. It's about 700 pages. But
just right at least, to the beach.
Yeah, at least on my. I read Ulysses at the beach a couple of years ago, so it can be done. But this is really, it's hard to put down. Yeah. It's a fantastic read.
And the title again.
The title is The Unconsoled.
All right. Jill.
Well, I have to say, on this topic in general, I thought, I'm not sure this is the right topic for the beach reading series.
Anything's good for beach reading.
But then you start digging deeper and you're like, well, yeah, this wouldn't be bad to read. And I also was having, there are just so many books about the brain in general. And so I started, after being overwhelmed by what were on the library shelves, I thought, well, let me see and look at what I have on my bookshelves at home, which will be more comfortable, and I will have some knowledge of them. And so I did actually find two books which both have little bits about the brain, but both are really interesting. And I'm just going to mention them and read just a little bit of them because they are both have very different takes on the brain, but they're both really interesting. One of them is from 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet by Pamela Paul, who I love this book anyway because it reminds me of all the things we have indeed lost. And one of the chapters is memory. And she writes, do you remember when we used to hold on to basic facts and daily obligations all by ourselves without a single pop-up reminder? Not anymore. We've given up the job of remembering anything on our own and left our memories to the cloud. Creating a new memory involved observing things, using our full attention as they happened. It meant writing things down by hand, collecting, sorting, and shelving, creating a long-term memory in this earlier brain-based system, which I love that that's what she calls it, required the absorption and retention of factual detail, conceptual comprehension, and synthesis. You construct these memories and then slept on them overnight, and a good portion of them still remained in the morning. There was information that you were regularly forced by circumstance to recall: your bank account number, your locker combination, your parents' anniversary. Without visual assistance, you used your mind's eye. But we no longer give our brains those regular workouts. Not that we thought of them that way at the time. It was just what you did from an early age, starting in preschool. We don't bother memorizing things like poems or the first 40 digits of pi, the capital of Utah, and the 7 times table. Storing this bank of cultural knowledge was a signifier of adulthood and of a fine education, if not necessarily a sign of intelligence. But now it's all online.
Oh, my.
And she goes on, you know, to talk more about how, and much of this book is about, well, given the title, 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet, are about things that she really misses. And I have a lot of sympathy with the things that she misses. I, too, miss many of these things. But it's a great book. And that essay, you can check out that book and read the rest of it. And the other book that has a little section in it about memory is a book that also lives on my shelves, and I'm sure I've brought previously to the radio show, called Madness, Rack, and Honey, Collected Lectures by Mary Ruffel. And she has in here, well, it's a section called 22 Short Lectures, and one of the lectures is short lecture on the brain. And she is talking about the right brain, left brain business. And it begins, "Research on the human brain continues to be a last frontier of exploration. It is that and outer space, the two together representing the outer reaches of human seeking at this time. How we are to get along with each other remains, of course, the most crucial of the inner reaches. But as for the outer reaches, well, friend, it's the brain and the stars." So much research has been done and reported on that you and I are likely to take for granted certain conclusions that are bound to be knocked down and busted through and reduced to rubble in the future. And one of them has to do with creativity and has become, to my mind, such a cliche that we must be vigilant. I am talking about the right brain, left brain cliche. And she goes through why she thinks that left brain, right brain thing is nonsense, and not nonsense, but that there's a lot more to your brain than everything things happening on one side or the other. And it's quite interesting. And she ends it with, "How can the idea of balance reside at only one side of a seesaw? This is what troubles me when I think about the notion of right brain, left brain. And every time I use the distinction, I'm ashamed, because I know it can't help an artist, nor can it help the person who can read and speak. And God help the one who is both."
That's funny.
That is the short lecture on the brain in Mary Ruffel's book, Madness, Rack, and Honey, Collected Lectures.
Oh, good one. All right.
Very good.
Yeah, Jane.
So, dipping back into nonfiction, Brain on Fire by Susanna Cahalan. You may have heard of this. It was a best-selling memoir when it came out in 2012. And it's also been made, of course, like everything else, has been made into a Netflix film. but the author chronicles her sudden descent into madness and the harrowing journey to recover from this. She, I believe she was in New York City, based in New York City, working as a writer, suddenly started to sort of lose control of her mind and her body. It happened within a span of about 2 months. And she had no idea what was going on, and neither did anybody else. I want to read just a short piece of her synopsis of the book. I'm not giving anything away from this highly recommended read. "My initial symptoms emerged a few months before my hospitalization. I was lethargic, depressed, unmotivated, and completely obsessed by the notion that bedbugs had invaded my apartment. Weeks later, I became manic and psychotic. I started seizing. I saw things that weren't there. After grand mal seizures and a delusional breakdown at my father's house, I was finally hospitalized. Dozens of doctors consulted on the case. Their working diagnosis was schizoaffective disorder. By the second week in the hospital, I could no longer write my own name, I couldn't walk on my own, and I could barely utter full sentences. A month in, after a brain biopsy and several spinal taps, I received my diagnosis and became the 217th person in the world with a newly discovered form of encephalitis.
Wow.
So this very physical manifestation in her brain was for over a month misdiagnosed as a mental disorder.
Wow.
And so she describes this, you know, the complexities and the resilience of the brain, because of course she does survive this, and goes back to her normal life eventually. But the story of her, you know, the sort of the horrors of misdiagnosis and then the long, long recovery after
wow,
that.
That's
just an amazing
story. Yeah.
I haven't seen the Netflix film, but I'll look it up.
And the name of the book again?
It's Brain on Fire.
All right. Jill?
Well, I've read a novel as well. And this one is by one of our best listeners and talkers as well, Peter Abrahams.
Yep.
And this is his book called Oblivion, which I had never read before and decided this seemed to be the book to read. And it has one of the things I just... an aside that I really liked about this book is he managed in this book, which is very dark and not, you know, like a light read at all.
Nope. Mm-hmm.
He manages
it's a good
to
read,
get
though. Yeah.
It. Yeah, it's a very good read. Is Babar and Celeste, Goodnight Moon, and The Cat in the Hat. And I think that's pretty impressive that you can get all three of those books into the book that it is. And I also discovered, I saw this and then I saw that Joyce Carol Oates had written a review of this book in The New Yorker. And I was really surprised because none of that really seemed to hold together. But she was really interested in the book. And she writes, in the long, groping, and haphazard drama of evolution, human consciousness is a recent and precarious acquisition. Our anxiety at its precariousness has much to do with our increasing life expectancy. Living longer physically, what can we expect to experience mentally? Neurological impairment is something we're all too likely to know firsthand, and Peter Abrahams' suspense novel, Oblivion, makes of this condition something rich and strange, an investigation into, quote, lost time like some dark forest in a fairy tale, end quote. The protagonist is a 42-year-old Los Angeles private detective named Nick Petroff, who at first unknowingly suffers from a form of brain cancer, whose symptoms he attempts to rationalize or conflate with the progress of his current investigation. And it's quite an unnerving book. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of very unpleasant things that happen during the course of this book. And you're really having, I found reading it, it's like you're both listening to the narrator and you're listening to the, you're learning about this fellow who you are learning all these bits about him, but you don't really see the full picture until well into the book as to what's going on with his brain. But he doesn't realize really what's going on with his brain. And it says this, and this is another abridged version of what's happening in this novel from the New York Times. Petroff, as Mr. Abrahams calls him here, has worked his way deep into a missing persons case, tracking down a teenage girl named Amanda when the headache explodes. It becomes a seizure after such harbingers as Petroff's strange, inappropriate word choices and nagging malaise. Petroff is hospitalized. The headache is diagnosed as grade 4 brain cancer. Oblivion is so circuitously plotted that the reader's memory gets as much of a workout as Nick's does. And how I felt about this as well. But it is most interesting for the light elliptical voice with which Mr. Abrahams discloses information. Here, Nick realizes that something strange has happened to the woman he is questioning. Her eyes were wide open, a beautiful blue of the lightest possible shade, but sightless. Stroke? He turned her over, still couldn't see what was wrong with her. The color of her shirt fooled him, masking what was going on. It was only when he checked his hands suddenly sticky that he began to understand. Red, red, red. You could read this on the beach. It'd be less scary, maybe, if you're reading it on the beach.
There you go. That's Oblivion by Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to suggest a book with a bit of the brain in it. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll have more after break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show, and our theme this month is The Brain. With us is retired reference librarian Jill Erickson and Jane Ifrady, who's the past chair of the Falmouth Reads Together. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Matt sent an email. He's suggesting a book by Kara Bean, just published, Here I Am Me, An Illustrated Guide to Mental Health. There's a chapter on the brain, a chapter on the mind, and how these influence our mental health. Matt, thanks for that suggestion. Jane, what's next?
Well, I couldn't show up today without thinking about Oliver Sacks, who is sort of the gold standard of neurology and writing about the brain. He's done such a wonderful job over the course of his lifetime of helping the layperson understand some very serious, complex neurology and sort of medical content. So I was thinking about two books today that I thought were both classics, influential, and certainly that stuck with me. The first one is The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, which again is sort of when you think of Oliver Sacks, that's the book you think about. And he spends most of this in case studies from his own practice as a neurologist. Starting with the title characters, which is a man who his brain condition left him unable to recognize faces and objects. I think what's most notable about this text is just how sympathetic Oliver Sacks is in his writing about these people who, the stories are very funny, but he never is making fun of any of these conditions. He treats every single one of them as very serious, of course, some of these things are notable because they come out of nowhere, sort of similar to Brain on Fire. When the brain does its thing, things change dramatically for people, and Sacks does a really great job of sort of describing what ordinary people go through when their brains just sort of go awry. The other book, and I heard a lecture from a grad student who had worked with Sacks on some of his research in this area, is called Musicophilia, The Tales of Music in the Brain. So if you love music and you love brain science, this is definitely a place to go. He talks not entirely just about the science of how music interacts with the brain and then causes certain behaviors. He just tells these incredible stories, a couple of them here. A man struck by lightning who suddenly desires to become a pianist at the age of 42. People who think that a symphony sounds like clattering pots and pans. crazy people, a group of children born with Williams syndrome, which makes them hyper musical from birth. So they're acutely attuned. Yeah.
So that's when you hear about all those three-year-olds who can play the piano. They must have that.
We call them prodigies, but there's a lot of brain chemistry working behind the scenes.
Or even when you look at Alzheimer's patients who are no longer verbal, yet they can remember the words to music that they had when they were young.
So one of his examples, a man whose memory spans only 7 seconds for everything except music.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing.
Isn't it? Can you think about that?
Yes. Yeah.
How disconcerting.
Yeah.
And, you know, like all of us who can remember the lyrics from every high school tune we loved, but can't remember what we had for breakfast this morning.
True.
Really, it's really an engaging story. And the of course, the science is so solid behind it.
Right. And the name again is?
This one is Musicophilia, Tales of Music in the Brain.
All right. Kara's calling from New Bedford. Hi, Kara.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I had to call in when you were talking about books and the brain because I just, I'm a cartoonist and I just made a book about mental health for kids and I drew all the parts of the brain as different characters, the prefrontal cortex, your hippocampus, your amygdala. And so I felt like I should come and say hello to you all and let you know that my book exists. And I love that you're having this discussion.
I think we mentioned your book. Here I Am, I Am Me, An Illustrated Guide to Mental Health, right?
That's right.
Yeah. We just mentioned it at the beginning of this segment. But yeah, so you got a double mention, Kara.
Wow.
I didn't realize it was a book for kids. So thanks for clarifying that. But that's great. That's good to know. Kara, thank you. Good luck with the book. Yeah. Appreciate
Thanks
that.
So much.
You bet. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill.
Well, I thought I'd pull out another children's book while we're on children's books. And this one is called Your Fantastic Elastic Brain, Stretch It, Shape It by Joanne Deke and illustrated by Sarah Ackerley. And I have to say what really caught my eye on this is, in fact, the illustrations. The illustrations are just great. And the beginning is, what does your brain really do? Does it fill the space between your ears? Well, yes, but your brain can do so much more. So, you know, it's got a sense of humor about it, which is really nice. And these illustrations are just terrific, which, alas, you cannot see when we're doing this on radio, but you can grab a copy. And then here's something. It says, your brain does all the things that make you, you. And then there is a section of what, you know, what it makes you, you. And there's a picture of likes red foods. Favorite word is elbow, ping pong champ, knows global landmarks, good at science, enjoys reading pirate books. And then at the bottom that there's little animals that are everywhere. And they say, the owl says, she's so unique. And the mouse says, my favorite word is foot. And so it's sort of got a sense of humor about everything, but you're also learning a lot about what the brain is. And it goes on to say, so what is your brain? Is it a muscle? No, the brain is an organ in your body. It's made up of cells and tissue. The brain controls everything you do, everything you think, everything you feel, even everything you dream. And they have, of course, an illustration of one of the dreams, and it's greetings, earthlings, welcome to planet Oregon. So there's definitely a great sense of humor for adults in here, as well as if they're reading the picture book to their child. It's just a lovely, and again, the illustrations really make, you know, when you have a picture book on your hands brains, you want to have really meaningful illustrations, but also giving you a lot of information out about your fantastic elastic brain.
I love the title. All right, Jane.
Well, I'm also going to pile on the picture books. One of my favorites. And this is a topic that we were discussing before we went on air, sort of applying human thought processes to dogs. In their behaviors. So I brought with me the Martha Speaks series by New England-based author Susan Mehta. So you may know this, not only because there was a series of five or six Martha Speaks books, but it was also an Emmy-nominated PBS series for children, of course. So let me read you just a little bit of the setup for the Martha Speaks series. When Helen Finney feeds alphabet soup to her dog, Martha, the letters go to her brain instead of her stomach, and Martha begins to speak. Having a talking dog is a lot of fun, unless your dog never stops talking. My dogs would fall into this category. When chatty Martha gives her family the silent treatment, they're relieved at first, But then they get worried. Will Martha ever speak again? I'll leave you there. But there is a series, and this is the
so
Martha speaks.
Obviously,
the first.
She speaks again.
She speaks again.
It's not too big a secret.
They're walking the streets with the dog, and the dog offers advice to people they meet along the way, and, you know, asking other dogs about their, you know, ailments. That's and funny. All yeah. kinds of stuff. It's crazy right. fun.
Martha speaks. Chill.
Okay, the next book I have is Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World by Marianne Wolfe. I have sort of, I have a lot of, I would say, books that sort of air to the troubles of having everything online. Although not entirely. We have more coming up. But this one I found, and I think it's really interesting. As the New York Times said about it, they did a thing called A Simple Way to Build Intimacy Reading Aloud, Why Adults Should Read Aloud to One Another, and a few recommendations to get you started. And as any of you have listened to this radio show for any amount of time, you know that
I and my friend Mary
have read aloud for a very long time, decades now. But this book is, it says, many of us learn to enjoy being read to as children, under the crook of an arm where ideal reading begins, said Marianne Wolfe, a researcher and scholar at UCLA's School of Education and Information Studies and the author of Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. In adulthood, we may not put each other under a physical crook of an arm, but we put each other under an emotional crook of the arm, Dr. Wolfe said. And research suggests the act of reading aloud may benefit the reader, too. It may improve memory, cognitive function, focus, and mood. Focus on your connection rather than getting every word right. Typically, Dr. Wolfe said, we think about reading as this cognitive and linguistic activity, but it also activates empathetic areas in our brain that trigger our ability to go beyond ourselves and to reach into the thoughts and feelings of others.
Wow.
In the act of reading, she added, we are transmitting emotions. We are transmitting affection. And I think that it's really a very interesting sort of book. It is certainly promoting reading as something that can be very, very helpful to your brain. And she was also the author of Proust and the Squid, which unraveled the tangled story of how the human brain learned to read and how reading has transformed our thoughts and emotions as a species. And now that we are completely immersed in the internet and our digital devices, our ways of processing written language have altered dramatically. Many of us are concerned about the resulting changes within ourselves and worry about what they may mean for the next generation. But inspired by the new research, Reader Comes Home describes in a series of letters Wolfe's own concerns and hopes about what is happening to the brain as it adapts to digital mediums. She raises difficult questions. And part of that is, again, just deep reading and what that does for you and what happens when you're not doing that. You're just, things are flashing in front of you every day, every minute. In any case, it is called Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World by Marianne Wolfe.
Mm, that sounds interesting.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Jane?
I'm back into fiction, and this is a collection of short stories. The title is Exhalation, written by Ted Chiang. People may recognize the name Ted Chiang. He's been sort of the writer or some of the brains behind a number of recent science fiction adventure type movies. But he writes largely about AI and the interface between sort of the human brain and artificial intelligence. And this is a nonfiction collection. It's a collection of short stories. And I would like to focus on two of the short stories in that collection that I cannot stop thinking about. I mean, I read this book just over like the course of a day.
Wow.
And it just amazing, amazing stories with people and things in them you just can't forget. The first one, the title of the story is The Life Cycle of Software Objects. And it's more of a novella than a short story. It runs about 100 pages, and it's sort of the centerpiece of the collection. The title, Life Cycle of Software Objects, is sort of a clinical title for what ends up being this sort of warm, soft, and fuzzy exploration of what it means to develop the brain of somebody else. So you could make an allusion to parenting or training your dog or whatever it is. And so it focuses on these two actual humans who are trainers for these little entities. They're sort of like digital pets called Digients. Huh. And you don't really kind of know what form they are. I'm kind of imagining these like little colorful, squiggly, half-human, half-animal kind of thingies. But they live in a virtual world. And they're sort of like, what were those like Tomodachi things from the 80s where you had to keep something alive.
Right.
These things are developed to sell as an entertainment commodity. So the trainers take them so far in their training, language, behavior, and then
in a good way.
Well, yeah, and that's really the point of this. And then they sell them. And there are certain rules for these things to live in this little digital community, but you almost immediately see the impacts when trainers do bad things or people in the outside world do bad things to develop the minds of these things, because they start to, at the beginning of the story, they sort of start to develop their own wants and desires, and you're thinking, oh, these are very bad very quickly. But I think what sort of brings this story home is that the development of the brains of these Digients are wholly dependent on the person who is with them, guiding them through their digital lifetimes. And the two main characters they've imprinted sort of these wonderful humanistic ethical characteristics in these things, but what you learn at the end of the story about whether that's good or bad. But it's just it's really I can't stop thinking about this story.
It's interesting,
crazy. It's sort of all about free will and self-determination and, you know, what's fixed and what's not fixed, and the role of parenting. And it was just really kind of very interesting. A second story in the collection, again, this is Exhalation by Ted Chiang. It's kind of amusing and frightening at the same time, is Dacey's Patent Automatic Nanny. What could go wrong?
Wasn't that a Hitchcock film or something?
Yeah. No. So this inventor, it feels very kind of like industrial revolutionist time period, but you don't know really what the time period is. He determines that he is going, you know, his wife is too busy to take care of the children. The nannies are too much trouble to deal with. Can't I build a robot to take care of my children? And he experiments, of course, on his own son. And what it turns out is that the son prefers the electronic or the robotic nanny to any other inputs in its life. And it's like wholly dependent on his development as a person on the nanny. And so what does that mean? And then, of course, you know, things don't go.
They never do.
Entirely to plan.
We've got an email from Carol in West Yarmouth who says, an interesting recent book of fiction regarding the workings of the brain is Jodi Picoult's Wish You Were Here. I have not read that one, but thank you for that. Appreciate that. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to make a suggestion for books on the brain. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show, and the brain is our theme for this month. With us is retired reference librarian Jill Erickson and Jane Afraidy, who's past chair of Falmouth Reads Together. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill.
Okay, so I've decided it's time to bring in the birds and their brains.
Bird brains, okay.
After hearing about the nanny, I was like, let's move on to birds. The Genius of Birds by Jennifer Ackerman is the book. And I love just the beginning of this, the intro of this book. For a long time, the knock on birds was that they're stupid, beady-eyed, and nut-brained. Reptiles with wings, pigeon heads, turkeys. They fly into windows, peck at their reflections, buzz into power lines, blunder into extinction. Our language reflects our disrespect. Something worthless or unappealing is for the birds. An ineffectual politician is a lame duck. To lay an egg is to flub a performance. To be henpecked is to be harassed with persistent nagging. Eating crow is eating humble pie. The expression bird brain for a stupid, foolish, or scatterbrained person entered the English language in the early 1920s because people thought of birds as mere flying, pecking automatons with brains so small they had no capacity for thought at all. And then the next line is, that view is a gone goose. And she talks about this. And in one of the reviews, it says, science writer Ackerman looks at the new science surrounding avian intelligence. The takeaway, calling someone a bird brain, is a compliment. Mm-hmm. And in any event, as Ackerman observes early on, intelligence is a slippery concept, even in our own species, tricky to define and tricky to measure. Is a bird that uses a rock to break open a clamshell, the mental equivalent of a tool-using primate? Perhaps that's the wrong question, for birds are so unlike humans that it's difficult for us to fully appreciate their mental capabilities, given that they're really just small, feathered dinosaurs who inhabit a wholly different world from our once arboreal and now terrestrial one. Crows and other corvids have gotten all the good publicity related to bird intelligence in recent years. But Ackerman, who does allow that some birds are brighter than others, points favorably to the much despised pigeon as an animal that, quote, can remember hundreds of different objects for long periods of time, discriminate between different painting styles, and figure out where it's going, even when displaced from familiar territory by hundreds of miles. Not bad for a critter best known for bespattering statues in public parks.
That's an excellent book. I've read that book.
Great.
No, she's wonderful. Jennifer Ackerman, anything she writes, she's great. Yeah.
It's The Genius of Birds by Jennifer Ackerman.
Right. Fantastic.
Jane.
So I'm not a huge self-help book kind of person. Unless I know that if I could do the research and make sure that the person who's written it is really has got the serious scientific backing, and so I don't have any hesitation in recommending Chatter, The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters, and How to Harness It by Ethan Cross. Now this is a textbook if you enjoy Shankar Vedantam's Hidden Brain series.
He's awesome.
This is the book to read. So Cross is a neuroscientist. He's at the University of Michigan, and he's the founder of the Emotion and Self-Control Lab, which studies the intersection of the brain, social media, and relationship behavior. So very interesting. So in this book, he examines how people conduct dialogues in our heads, which we all do, from everything about work issues to personal relationships to running a marathon. We often give too much credence to our inner voices when we should be actually kind of taking them for what they're worth and applying the same sort of scientific knowledge that he does to our own inner voices. And so through this book, he teaches us a little bit how to do that. He goes into case studies in the same way that Oliver Sacks does in a lot of his books. He discusses a pitcher who forgets how to pitch, or a Harvard undergrad who is negotiating her double life as a spy. I mean, kind of crazy stuff, right? And he looks at the sort of like the way that self chatter sort of disorients us in a lot of ways, and the impacts that it can have on all of our sort of, you know, physical, social performance relationships. And so then he offers tips at the end on how to sort of think about those voices differently, harness the ones that work well, dismiss the ones that are getting in the way.
Yeah. And the name again
really
is Chatter.
Interesting. Chatter by Ethan Cross.
I like that one. All right, chill.
Okay. At one point, the Wall Street Journal wrote a series of the 5 best books on the brain.
Whoa.
And they all are pretty interesting. But the one that stuck out for me was The Psychobiotic Revolution, Mood, Food, and the New Science of the Gut-Brain Connection. Hmm. By Scott C. Anderson, with John Scryan and Ted Deenan, which came out in 2017. Decades ago, the idea that the microbes in your gut could influence your mental health seemed far-fetched. In The Psychobiotic Revolution, the journalist Scott C. Anderson, along with the scientists John F. Cryan and Ted Deenan, tell us the gut-brain axis is real. The trillions of microbes in our digestive system can affect our mood, behavior, and mental well-being. How can you promote gut health? Avoid processed foods. I mean, this is all sort of, you know, I think people already are really doing this now, given that this came out some time ago. Avoid processed foods, eat more fermented foods, and consume more fiber. While the discovery that the gut had its own nervous system occurred in the 18th century, which is pretty impressive, it was only in the 20th century that it was recognized as the second brain. Messrs. Cryan and Deenan, who together coined the term psychobiotics, have published articles recognizing the powerful role the microbiome plays in mental health. One of the most important revelations, Mr. Anderson writes, is that for many people, anxiety and depression can have a microbial component. You can take charge of your gut to optimize your mind and your mood. Mm-hmm. So this is The Psychobiotic Revolution, by Scott Anderson.
Right. Barbara in Fairhaven says, I want to recommend The Brain's Way of Healing by Norman Dodge, who discusses the neuroplasticity of the brain. Very readable book. She's got a little explanation here. It says, Dodge explores cases where patients alleviated chronic pain, recovered from debilitating strokes, brain injuries, and learning disorders, overcame attention deficit and learning disorders, found relief from symptoms of autism, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, and cerebral palsy. Barbara, thanks for that. That's The Brain's Way of Healing by Norman Dodge. Jill.
Wow. So back to fiction for me, and it wouldn't be an appearance on The Point if I did not mention a Michael Crichton book, one of my favorites.
And I thought you were going to say Moby Dick. But you already mentioned Moby Dick.
That's about everything, so that's an evergreen. But really one of my favorite Michael Crichton books is The Terminal Man, which was published in 72, made into a movie, I believe. Anyway, Crichton describes this book as his least favorite.
Really?
Right. But it had a great reception, and it spawned a lot of what we see in entertainment in terms of sort of the AI, the brain-computer interface. So this particular novel revolves around Harry Benson, who's a computer scientist. He starts to have seizures, and he becomes violent during the seizures. So his medical team decides that the best remedy for that is to hook up 40 electrodes into his brain and connect them to a little mini computer outside of his body and see how that works. It was going to stimulate his brain so he doesn't have these very violent outbreaks. Of course, you know, again, what could go wrong? Anyways, it doesn't work, of course.
It does go wrong.
But it gives the scientists a lot of time to kind of figure out what would happen if you hooked up somebody to 40 electrodes. It's, you know, I thought it was a great read when I read it at the time in the 1970s. But, you know, Michael Crichton is an author who spent a lot of time thinking about sort of the human-computer influence. And, of course, he was the brains behind the original Westworld movie.
I was going to say Westworld.
Right. He wrote and directed that, and that's all about sort of sentient robots that, you know, that sort of become more than they were programmed to be.
Which is an understatement.
Right, exactly. And then spawned the more recent series, Westworld, which even goes farther than the original Westworld ever did. But again, it's sort of thinking about how, you know, in the 1970s, we were at a point in sort of the brain and computer science world where we're already able to apply some very complex theories and in areas to fiction. I think was just amazing that he took advantage of it.
Yeah. Okay, Jill.
Well, I felt I had to bring this book. I don't know. I think because it was making me think about what one's brain does when it's really agitated. And the book is Wherever You Go, There You Are, Mindfulness Meditation in Everyday Life by Jon Kabat-Zinn. Mm-hmm. I'm sure many of you have heard of this book, but I feel it's necessary to I think the world at large needs more mindfulness.
You're right about that.
There was a question. There was an interview with him in the Globe, and the question was, and awareness of sensations is also crucial. And he says, the practice of cultivating mindfulness really goes through the sensors. That's why the first exercise we have people to do is eat a raisin. One raisin for about 10 minutes. They just look at it for 3 to 4 minutes, smell it for a minute or two, put it in the mouth and slowly take a few bits and really put awareness in the mouth. And then experience the explosion of tasting. People will say, the most amazing things. Like, I don't think I ever ate a raisin before with awareness. They'll say after one or two raisins, I actually feel full. So, which is sort of like, wow, that's pretty strong stuff there, huh? And the book itself has some really good things, of course, about meditation, because that's what he's all about. And he one of the chapters is, can anybody meditate? And he writes, but meditation is not about feeling a certain way. It's about feeling the way you feel. It's not about making the mind empty or still, although stillness does deepen in meditation and can be cultivated systematically. Above all, meditation is about letting the mind be as it is and knowing something about how it is in this moment. It's not about getting somewhere else, but about allowing yourself to be where you already are. If you don't understand this, you will think you're constitutionally unable to meditate, but that's just more thinking. And in this case, incorrect thinking at that. True meditation does require energy and a commitment to stick with it. But then wouldn't it be more accurate to say, I won't stick with it, rather than I can't do it? Anybody can sit down and watch their breath or watch their mind. So a great book. It really has held up. It's Wherever You Go, There You Are by Jon Kabat-Zinn.
All right, you got a minute, Jill. I mean, Jane. A minute left.
I can do it. All right, so I'm just going to give a quick shout out to Falmouth author Lisa Jo Rudy, who's written a lot. She's an advocate for children with autism and their parents. And so she has written a book called Get Out, Explore, and Have Fun, How Families of Children with Autism or Asperger Syndrome Can Get the Most Out of Community Activities.
Oh, that sounds good.
So a fantastic resource for parents who are in this realm. And Lisa's a great writer.
Nice. Good to know. All right. And we will have a link with all the books we talked about today on our website a little bit later today. We've got to put it together. So you'll find that at capeandislands.org. Our monthly book show is the last Wednesday of the month. Jane Ifrady and Jill Erickson, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.